Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, an opportunity to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My very special guest today is author Terry Turchie. Terry was a longtime FBI investigator. In fact, he was the lead investigator on a couple of very, very high-profile cases, the hunt for Ted Kaczynski, otherwise known as the Unabomber, and also the Olympic bomber, Eric Rudolph. Good afternoon, Terry, and welcome to the show.
Simon, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing very well indeed, and you?
Good. I am just great. Thank you.
I always like to ask authors this question. What made you decide to become an author?
Well, you know, Simon, I actually, as you know, co-authored Hunting the American Terrorist, the first book I wrote, and Homeland Insecurity, How Washington Politicians Have Made America Less Safe, with Dr. Kathleen Puckett. Dr. Puckett is a clinical psychologist. As you mentioned, both of us were in the FBI, and our time there totaled about 60 years. We each retired after about 30 years with the Bureau. And we had just looked around and saw what was out there regarding the hunt for Theodore Kaczynski and then what had happened in the search for Eric Robert Rudolph, as you said, the Olympic bomber, and decided that the real facts were not out in front of the public. And we felt it very, very important and very crucial in order to learn from what we learned in those experiences. I mean, the Unabomber case went on for 18 years. And so we felt like there was so much misinformation that we wanted to get out some of the real facts. And that's what we prompted us to write the first book. And the second book was prompted by the world events and the fast-changing situation out in the world with respect to the war on terrorism. And we decided to find out what really brought on the 9/11 attack and what kind of things can we do and what kind of mistakes have our politicians made that will make America safer in the future if we talk about these and try and learn from them. So that's what prompted us to write those books.
Mm. You seem to have found pretty much a perfect fit with the publishing house History Publishing Company. You meet their criteria exactly. How did you find them, or did they find you?
That's a great story, a great question and a great story. And before I even give you the full answer, I have to tell you, we have gotten so much out of our relationship with History Publishing Company and the publisher there, Don Bracken. And it's so discouraging sometimes, excuse me, for first-time authors, and we've just learned a great deal from the chances and the kind of the bet that Don Bracken and History Publishing placed on us. The story is kind of interesting. My co-author has a group of friends, all of whom were former female FBI agents. They kind of call themselves, you know, the Girls Club. And after they retired, they decided they needed to kind of stay in touch. And so every year they would somewhere in the country, somewhere in the United States, they would have a reunion. And there's about six or seven of them. And they would get together for two or three nights and just reminisce about old times and talk about what each other are doing. And one of these agents had a good friend, and she ran an inn out in Martha's Vineyard. And they decided to have the actual reunion out there. And so when they got together, Kathy Puckett, met the owner of the inn, and she's a writer. She writes what is called the Martha's Vineyard Mystery Series. And so one thing led to another, and she was able to get us in touch with History Publishing Company and Don Bracken. Don had actually stayed out at the inn out there in Martha's Vineyard. And Don said, well, send me a copy of your outline. Send me a copy of what you plan to write. And I'm talking now about that first book, the Hunting the American Terrorist. And so we sent it off to Don, and he sent us back an email a few days later, and he said, well, here are some suggestions. So we thought, okay, that's good. It's nice that he took the time to offer us some suggestions about how we could make the book better. And so we sent him back an email. We said thank you, and we kind of implemented some of his changes and said, here's just for your information what we did. And the next thing we knew, he was sending us a contract and said, hey, I'd like to publish your book. And so we had, at that point in time, this was back in 2006, we had also been working on the idea for the second book. Of course, even though we hadn't found a publisher for the first one. And so we asked him if we could send him the idea for Homeland Insecurity, How Washington Politicians Have Made America Less Safe. So we sent it to him, and he sent us back an email. He said, I'm going to publish that one too. So we were off and running, and very, very excited that we were going to be able to get both of these books out in the public realm.
So you were actually incredibly lucky. It doesn't sound like you went through the 60 rejection letters from every publishing house known to man.
We were pretty lucky, Simon. We actually started this process by trying to get a literary agent. And we did get, I would say maybe, I don't want to exaggerate or, you know, overdo this, probably about 10 rejections. And actually, they weren't that bad. I mean, people would take some time, and a couple of them kind of asked a few questions and, you know, didn't immediately reject us. But so that was all going on. And in the process of that, we actually got another offer from one publishing company to do the first book, and decided for a number of reasons that we didn't want to take them up on it. And about that time is when we got in touch with Don. So, you know, as I look back, even though to us that seemed like a great deal of rejection, and we weren't really used to being rejected that much in our earlier careers, you know, and so maybe it wasn't that bad. It looked kind of dismal while it was going on, but again, if you look back on it, it probably was pretty good for us.
Actually, I was talking to Don Bracken about a week ago or so, and he told me an incredibly funny story, and I do hope you won't be upset by it if I relay it. We were talking about the first time he heard about hunting the American terrorist. He said he was really excited and asked you for a manuscript. And the only problem was that the manuscript that he read just like an FBI report. Was it a big challenge, sort of learning how to write for the layman?
For us, that was huge, Simon. We didn't really realize. I mean, I think we had a feel that we were probably going to have to learn to write a little differently if we were going to tell this story in a way that people would be interested in reading it. But we really had no idea how bad it really was. And it did. It read like on this date, we did this, and on this date, we did this. And he was very nice in the way he tried to explain to us that this needs to be, think of this as a nonfiction novel. And a reader has to pick it up, and they're going to be enticed to buy it maybe or want to read it once they see the title, the cover, that'll pull them in. But once they get pulled in and they turn to the first chapter, then it's got to be a story. It's got to grab them and get their attention, because if it doesn't, then, you know, in the first few minutes, you're lost. And so it took us a while to get beyond this FBI report writing style. The old, if you've heard in the public realm with all these congressional hearings and everything, the FBI, what they call FD 302, the FBI reporting form, and all those start with the first paragraph is always the same. Simon Barrett, address such and such, telephone number such and such. Blue eyes, blonde hair, glasses, was interviewed on this date and provided the following information. And, you know, that's what we had to get around. And we actually found that to be a lot of fun and a real challenge. But we had a tremendous ally in Don Bracken, who not only has a real knack to identify and know how to tell a story, but also to serve as a mentor in bringing you along without discouraging you and making you feel bad along the way, I guess kind of through the editorial process. And I mean, he came up with some great ideas for hunting the American terrorist as far as the way we would tell that story. And then in the second book, Homeland Insecurity, through a number of conversations as we were trying to get a grasp on how would we write this type of book and how would it be all tied together, he actually helped us a great deal in walking down the road and suddenly discovering this whole notion of why do we have these terrible problems in America? Why do we make such bad decisions? This is when we got into this whole notion of the addiction to power, and that ended up, as you know, being the theme that brought that book together.
Right. Yeah, I must admit, I always enjoy talking to Don. I've never had any, quote, business dealings with him. You know, I'm a reviewer, he's a publisher. But he's such an intelligent and sharp guy. You know, he really hones in on things that other people may miss.
Well, that's exactly right. And the beauty of having, for those of your listeners, for example, and I think so many people out there not only have stories that they wish to tell, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, but also have the ability and the talent to write a book, this whole idea of this the trade of the boutique-type publisher, the smaller publishing house, there's a lot to be said as far as the creative aspect of dealing with a publishing, a smaller publishing company. But to get a person like Don Bracken, who can also walk you through the ins and outs of how a book can really become a book, from an idea to a real story, for us was a great find. And I think that one of the biggest challenges facing people who want to write and who want to get their story out there, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is first of all making the time and actually taking that idea and actually putting it on paper and watching it come to life, but also to have the opportunity to have somebody help them who has been in the field and who understands how you can take an idea and actually make it a story that people want to read. And that's the real challenge, I think. You know, Kathy and I thought that we had some real good ideas here and that just about anybody would want to read about the chase for the Unabomber or the hunt for a domestic terrorist or 40 years of bad and highly partisan political decisions. But the problem is if you don't put it in a format and with something somewhat unique that sets it apart and makes it a little different, then it's either not ever going to get published or it'll just kind of fall to the wayside and instead of over time selling consistently out there to people who want to read about things in a different light.
Right. One of the big mistakes that I see in a lot of first-time authors is they've banged their head against the brick walls and of publishing houses and literary agents, you know, and they've finally found someone willing to publish the book, and they sit down and, you know, heave a sigh of relief and think their job is done. Actually, getting a book in print is only the starting point. Now you've got to persuade people to buy the thing. Did you have a pretty aggressive marketing campaign? Were you out there pounding the streets?
Well, that's a great question, and we've learned from trial and error. The first book, we depended more on the publishing company, on Don, to put together a plan, and we decided to do, since we were new, we decided that we needed to get out there and kind of be known in different local geographical areas. So we actually did a 14-day book tour where we signed books at Barnes & Noble and Borders and Books A Million. We did all this on the East Coast. We started, it was around the middle of September 2007, and by the end of the month, we made our way from Washington, D.C. to Boston. And I think we did about 12 or 13 book signings. We did some a couple of radio shows. When we were in New York, we did Fox and Friends in the morning on a Sunday morning. That was kind of fun. And we found that it worked in that it did get the word out, but it's a tremendous amount of time and energy. and you're reaching smaller groups. So we decided in the second go-around that we should probably focus a little differently and try to focus more on radio and television and written reviews. And so that's what we did. We actually hired our own publicist, Susan Schwartzman, PR, out of New York. And that really has worked out very well. And we found that in the process of publicizing and being out there publicizing the second book, Homeland Insecurity, we're also finding that the sales, interestingly, for Hunting the American Terrorist have also gone up as well. So we started back in Washington. We did a number of morning shows on a number of networks. We went up to Seattle, and we were there for about a week, did the same thing. And here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we've done radio and talk shows and some morning television. So all of that has helped. We're now going back and doing book signings because we're now finding that some of the both private or smaller and also the bigger bookstores like Barnes & Noble now will have us back to sign the book. So here, several months, 6 months out, the book is still out there and people are still buying it. And and actually both books are still somewhat popular as far as people buying copies of the first one as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed that you're not an infrequent guest on the TV stations these days.
No, we're actually on there more often. You're right. And I think that the message from the second book, certainly, is something that will kind of stay with us over time. I mean, unfortunately, Simon, I think most people recognize that the threat of another terrorist attack on America is real. And we just simply haven't solved the fundamental problem and arrested or found the right people yet to be sure that we could substantially cut into the odds that we're going to be attacked again. And I think that by getting out there with this message, and as you know from reading the second book and the first, Kathy and I, Dr. Puckett, believe very, very firmly that we're forgetting our best resource in dealing with terrorism, and that's the American public. We need to get the word out, and we need to make sure people realize that our ability to prevent future terrorist acts and, in fact, our capability to find people that we want to find now for acts they've committed already is directly related to public help. And in order to be helpful, the public has to know. They have to be aware of the facts. They have to know what they're looking for. They have to know how they can help. And that is relatively free compared to the billions and billions and billions of dollars we've spent in our terror strategy. And yet, how many times do you really see a public official emphasizing repeatedly that we need your help and here's how we need it and here's what we'd like to see from you? And we don't understand that. I'll give you an example. Let me just give you an example, two examples of how that's been so significant in the last decade. We're talking, or you've mentioned Theodore Kaczynski and the Unabomber. 18 years that case went on. And it wasn't until we decided to combine the elements of a strategy that involved reinvestigating all of those Unabomber events, 16 events over 18 years, digging up every fact, putting together a composite of the information we knew to be accurate and that we had in front of us, emphasizing and building a much more significant analytical capability to look at all that information and tie it together, and then finally having a public strategy. And if you think back to the days we dealt with the Unabomber case, we went out early on and we said, think of the Unabomber not as some random series of attacks all over the country. Think of it like this, that we believe that the Unabomber was born, raised, and is extremely familiar with the Chicago, Illinois area. And think of that in the time frame of the late 1970s. We then think that in the mid-80s or the early 80s to the mid-80s, the Unabomber found himself very, very familiar with and possibly affiliated with the city of Salt Lake. And then finally, the San Francisco Bay Area from the mid-80s on, he is extremely familiar with, may in fact live in the Bay Area or have lived in the Bay Area. Think of that with those time frames, and then look at this composite where somebody had actually seen him in 1987, And then finally, when he himself sent out the Unabomber manuscript, the huge debate about to publish or not to publish, mm-hmm. we asked the Department of Justice and the New York Times and the Washington Post to consider publishing the paper, and we had one motive, and that was we believe from all that we knew about the Unabomber at that time and the information we analyzed that if we could get that published, it may be something that somebody would look at and become familiar with, and it might resonate. They might have seen those words or heard those thoughts from someone before.
Right.
And then that is exactly what happened. David Kaczynski recognized those words and called us. He was one of 55,000 people who called the Unabomber Task Force between September 19th of 1995 and the middle of February of 1996. And 2 months later, the 18-year hunt for the Unabomber came to an end.
Wow. Hunting the American Terrorist was a great, great book. And I'll share a little secret with you. Don sent me a pretty early copy of it, and it drove me nuts not being able to publish my review. I had to sit on it for weeks. I thought the book put a really human face on the cases. People have become hooked on the various CSI type shows on the TV, and reality is so different. You know, it seems to me that reality is thousands of hours piecing together a jigsaw puzzle that has no edge pieces, and nor do you have any idea what the finished picture will look like. And you need also that little bit of good luck thrown in for good measure.
Simon, that sums up the true state of investigations. And people are so, as you said, used to watching these TV shows, and the case is solved in 30 minutes, and it's all usually solved through all the fancy forensics and the rapid computer work. And it's exciting to watch. It's kind of amusing. But I often worry that this is actually giving new people, like new policemen and new FBI agents, the wrong impression about how these matters come together. Cases are made. The art of criminal investigation, and it is an art, it is not a science, is combining all the aspects of what science can offer and what other techniques can offer. But I remember back to my, I don't want to date myself too much, but my my junior college days, where my first two police science instructors, I remember them so clearly. David Plant had been in the California Highway Patrol, and Walter Garrett had been a detective in the police department in Berkeley, California. And these guys had they had worked right up to the time they started teaching college. And theirs was a very simple philosophy. The more people you talk to, the greater your chances are going to be of solving a crime. And if you don't talk to anybody, you're not going to solve a crime. And I thought, that's rather interesting. That's not what the TV show's saying.
Right.
And I found it to be true. And we need to obviously fill the ranks of the FBI and the Secret Service and police departments with talented and capable people of many backgrounds that understand and know computers and can deal with the real issues of crime today. But at its heart and at its base, criminal investigations continue to involve people. People interactions, and that goes for interactions with the families and family members of the victims, as well as all of the people that you talk to from the time a crime is committed to the time it's solved, to try to get through that door and find the right person and do it all in a very proper, legal way, adhering to the law of the land. And that's what makes America different. And that's also what makes us very successful over the
right.
long haul in ensuring that we can keep our crime rate down and we can have faith and confidence in our law.
Your second book, Homeland Insecurity, is cut from a very different cloth. Homeland is a much more political statement. I think it's fair to say that there's little love lost between the White House and the FBI. The FBI has been the one law enforcement organization that has resisted becoming under the thumb. In my personal opinion, I think it's important to have an external auditor. What was your motivation, or how did Homeland Insecurity come about?
Well, we just felt over the years that the FBI was just taking unjustified hits from Congress, and that after 9/11, I think that the American public has had a picture or a portrait painted by both parties, and of course they both have a stake in this, and the 9/11 Commission was kind of the group that tied the bow here around this package. The American public was led to believe through the 9/11 Commission that we were attacked on 9/11 because it was an intelligence and law enforcement failure. And that was kind of the last straw for us. The audacity of all of those people, and I'll give the example of Jamie Gorelick, who was former Deputy Attorney General, total conflict of interest in sitting on the 9/11 panel. These people knew for many years that the threat of terrorism was growing, that our political policies were not effective in dealing with it, and in fact some of them were increasing the chances of terrorist attacks against the United States. And after 9/11, when one incident is not prevented, and we always said that we can be, unlike a baseball player, for example, I'll give you this example. If you're a baseball player and you're up 10 times, and every 10 times you're up, you get 7 hits. I mean, you're like the best baseball player in the history of the game. Seven out of 10. Wow. But in our circle, we could not bat 9 out of 10. We could not bat 99 out of 100 because the terrorist attack that gets through has significant and tragic ramifications, and that's what happened. And the FBI, the CIA had been, and the elements of the military for years had been working very, very hard to prevent the kind of thing that happened on 9/11. On that day, we totally ran out of time, we ran out of luck, we ran out of just everything. And the sad thing is that since 9/11, we are still the victim of political policies and guidelines that have not helped us, in our opinion, and the reason we wrote this book, become safer. We are engaged in something that is a partisan war where both parties have shown their weakness. So Kathy and I decided to look back over about a 40-year time frame, and we were amazed at what we found, that our government has never handled terrorism right, whether it be domestic or international. If you look at a history of Republican administrations going back to Watergate, Richard Nixon and Watergate, you could argue that Watergate was the result of a misadventure and a misstep in trying to handle the issue of domestic terrorism of our day. And the Republicans seem to continue to repeat those kind of mistakes. We fast forward to the years of the second President Bush, and we go right back to warrantless wiretapping, to the torture issues, to things that lost the support of the American people and the world. And whether one wants to debate it or not, when we lost that support, we have been undercut in dealing with terrorism. On the other hand, you have the Democratic Party that over 40 years has never really seemed to even understand the significance of the threat of terrorism. They just don't seem to get it. So we have to hope in this day and age right now that not only in dealing with our economy but in dealing with terrorism, we have to hope that this administration can figure this out and get it right. And the final thing I would say along those lines is that while we're trying to deal with our economy, and we're in a very, very bad situation right now, we have to remember that part of this came about because of a tremendous amount of money we spent over the years trying to deal with terrorism after 9/11. And that is the purpose of terrorists, to wreak havoc on your economy. So all of us need to hope and pray that, you know, during this terrible time that we're facing trying to deal with the economy, we don't get attacked again, because our options are going to be severely limited.
Right. I know we're about to lose our live listeners. However, I will say to the live listeners, don't panic. If you go to www.bloggernews.net in about an hour or so, I will have a URL to the entire recorded interview. Terry, I'm guessing that you have been crossed off a few Washington Christmas card lists.
Well,
have you had any direct feedback from the, quote, establishment?
You know, it's interesting. We haven't, I'm thinking, we haven't heard from, of course, people in political positions. I don't know that we would. Haven't seen anybody really challenge anything we've written. We have gotten a tremendous amount of feedback, Simon, from both retired and current FBI agents and law enforcement officials. And I think that they're very, very pleased that we wrote this book. And I think it makes them feel like there are people out there that are willing to put forth something a little different tone and kind of set the record straight on some of the things that have happened in the last 40 years. And our biggest worry, of course, is that under the current alignment, and this is since 9/11, since the 9/11 Commission, we've taken some very significant steps, and I'm not sure the public recognizes the impact of these steps. We've built a Director of National Intelligence position, and this, of course, was supposedly targeted at the terrible, faulty analysis that preceded 9/11, and the idea that agencies just simply weren't working together. And we have a very powerful position there, headed by a director who reports to the president and who can literally reach out to some 22 agencies who deal with a piece of the intelligence puzzle and give an order to any of them. Now, if you look at the last 40 years of our history, that's kind of dangerous because we haven't seemed to get people who can have judgment or who can be their own person and simply tell a president that's not a good idea. History is just full of examples to where people seem to get into the corridor of power and they literally melt when they're sitting in front of these people. The mess we have today, I think, could be directly traced back to the idea that certain people did not truly give the president good advice or at least tell him in no uncertain terms that, you know, some of the things you're advocating here may not be a great idea. And if we don't have that, we will drift off into other problems that will become huge constitutional and tragic issues, result in tragic issues for the Republic. And I'm thinking of Watergate. I'm thinking of Iran-Contra. I'm thinking of the leak of the name of the CIA officer and in the Bush administration. And I think that you know, those kind of things are just not healthy. Just like the entry into Iraq, we all know now, and Kathy and I knew the day it happened. I mean, we looked at each other, why are we doing this? We all know that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Right.
Nothing. And this was not that hard to see what was going on. If you think back to right after 9/11, the very next week we had the anthrax attacks along the East Coast.
Yeah.
And that was the first time you saw, for example, James Woolsey, I use as an example, former CIA director, coming out in public and trying to tie the anthrax attacks to the regime of Saddam Hussein. That didn't work. In fact, the FBI jumped in and behind the scenes was saying, listen, there is no evidence to support this. But see, the government wanted something like that because they had to start building the foundation for what they wanted to do in the first place, which was to invade Iraq. After that didn't hold the day, it was the argument about the whole idea of the uranium in Niger, and that, of course, is when former Ambassador Wilson wrote a report and said, no, that's not, those facts aren't true. There wasn't anything going on here where Saddam Hussein was getting uranium. And so now we have another problem. And so now we have his wife's name leaked. And that, of course, didn't get us into Iraq either. So finally you have the situation involving weapons of mass destruction and
right.
their urgent use. And suddenly the whole thing galvanized and we're off and running. But it had nothing to do with the people who attacked us on 9/11. And that's the sad part of all this.
Right. Hunting the American Terrorist was a spectacular book, and I really thought it was New York Times bestseller material, but somehow the timing of its release was off. The book world was awash with terrorism books, and Hunting just didn't get the attention it deserved. Homeland Insecurity, on the other hand, had a timeliness that was masterful, you know, right before the election. How have sales been going for Homeland Insecurity?
Well, they've been going okay, Simon. I think that at the end of the day, they'll actually be similar, though, to Hunting the American Terrorist. The one plus for both of these books is that they continue to sell in a pretty consistent fashion. Hunting the American Terrorist, for example, the other day, and of course you realize this is all kind of the timing of the moment, but had been in the top 100 in the category of law enforcement on the Amazon ranking. It's not unusual that we'll go in there and they'll be, you know, they'll both be in the 65,000-70,000 ranking overall. And then you go in there the next day, and they're both up in the top 100 in politics or law enforcement or something like that. And then they'll dive again down into the 200s, 300s, 300,000 mark. And that's our only indicator, I guess, consistently. That's why I bring that up.
Right.
But I think that in an interesting way, we're somewhat satisfied that they're out there, they're still out there, that they are consistently being looked at. We get calls to this day about both books, and are just kind of happy that we're able to get out a different perspective. I think that's uniquely American, that we can really be out there and have these opportunities. And of course, people like yourself who have reviewed these books, that has been a huge assist for us, and we're glad that that people like them and that they do give a little bit of a different perspective, the perspective of an insider who, quite honestly, usually does not write about politics. Usually former FBI people, when they write books, write about their own experience, maybe more similar to what we did in Hunting the American Terrorist, but sometimes it's even more personal and focused than even that. But the Homeland Insecurity book was really kind of stepping out there and saying things that, certainly as a current FBI agent, you would never be able to say. And yet we thought, well, we're not current FBI agents anymore, and we can say this, and we should say this. So that's kind of what makes us feel good, that it's still selling, and hopefully they'll keep selling for many years.
Good, and I certainly hope they do. Terry, alas, our time has come to an end. I really want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today. It's been a delight, and I do wish you and Kathleen every success with your two current books and your new book. But more about that later.
Well, Simon, thank you very much, and have a great day, and I look forward to talking with you again.
You bet, and we certainly will talk again. Thank you again, Terry.
Thank you, Simon. Bye.